Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Journalism. I'm Kate Edenborg, the host of this channel, and today we'll be talking to Clyde Farnsworth about his new book, Tangled Bylines, A Father and Son Cover the 20th Century. And welcome, Clyde, to the podcast.
Hi, how are you?
Doing pretty good. So, Clyde, I was wondering if we could start off the interview here having you tell a little bit about yourself, and I know the book tells us a lot about yourself and your father, but if we could just kind of get a brief introduction.
Sure, happy to do that. You know, my life as a startup journalist can be summed up by my relationship with two gentlemen, my father and Uncle Sam. More about Uncle Sam later, but my dad worked for the AP for a long time. And we did lots of things together while he was working for the AP, and we went on long bike rides and played chess together. And the neighbors always thought that he was a food merchant because he worked for the AP, and they thought the AP was the A&P. But, of course, it was the greatest wire service and still is. And he took me to the office, and on those Sundays I especially loved because you could just wander about in this what was a kind of a depression kid. Remember, this is in the late 30s and early 40s. Mm-hmm. A depression kid's a Disneyland kind of place, because it was Rockefeller. The office was in Rockefeller Center in New York, and we wandered about. I wandered about and enjoyed the whole scene there, the escalators especially, and then the cable desk was especially interesting because there were all these men with everybody wore jackets in those days, and they loosened their collars, maybe they took off their jackets, and they were smoking a lot of cigarettes, and they would end up pounding the typewriters, and so I would pound the typewriters key, but instead of writing about the German invasion of Russia or something like that, I was writing about Superman, and my father had taught me how to type. So I'd be writing about werewolves and Superman and that kind of thing, and it was really very exciting to do all that. But and so what happens is a little bit later, he goes off as a war correspondent, and then he never comes back. And so I've got this crazy situation where I love my dad, and then suddenly he goes off with another woman and everything else, and I kind of hate my dad. And so the whole book becomes a story about how I, go from this hatred almost to admiration, later admiration and respect, because he was doing what he was called on to do professionally and personally he had a very difficult time also. So it was that kind of situation. Then now comes Uncle Sam. This is about 10 years later, and the Korean War is on, and so I end up in Korea. And at first, I go as I join the army, and I go as a combat medic in Heartbreak Ridge, and then after that, I was a combat reporter for the 45th Division News. That was after about 4 months on the Hill as a combat medic, and they made the switch because they needed somebody on the newspaper, and I was about the only person who had a college education in the whole unit, and so they plucked me. And of course, that probably saved my life, but it also taught me a lot about being a journalist. And so I ended up, writing quite a lot of combat stories. And then so after the war, I decided to just jump into the United Press and see what was happening. I didn't go to the AP because I had taken the train into Grand Central. I don't know if you know Manhattan or not, but anyway, the AP office is not too that close to the United. It's not that close to Grand Central, but the United Press in those days was in the Daily News Building, which was just one block away. So my first appointment was with the United Press, and they took me right away. And so I never even applied for another job. I went to the United Press, and then after 5 years at the UP, I ended up at the Herald Tribune, and that was a great, great newspaper. I don't mean to sound like Donald Trump, but it was a great, great newspaper in those days. And unfortunately, it failed after about 7 or 8 years. But by that time, I had joined the Times, and that was in an even greater experience, even more incredible, and suddenly I find myself in London and with the Beatles all these fantastic stories that were breaking at that time, and then I have a family. And so that's more or less the story of that. Well, then from London I go to Paris, and then from go to Brussels, and then to Paris, and then the whole thing continues. The Prague invasion, the invasion of 1968. Well, I'm jumping ahead a lot of years now because I'm trying to summarize in a short period of time. But anyway, it was quite an exciting period. It was incredible, and I will, of course, will never forget any of those moments.
You did a great job of summarizing your life in 5 minutes. So, you kind of started talking about this already, kind of talking about the different inspirations for your book. But
yes.
What was, like, you probably had, I'm kind of guessing you had thoughts of doing this potentially for a while, but how did you kind of come, what kind of nudged you to move forward with this book? Was it a process that started long ago, or did something strike you that happened to inspire you to do it now?
That's a great question. And what happened was that I was coming back to a good relationship with my father. I'd learned a lot of things about his life, and it was like the other side of the moon. I mean, I didn't know anything, and so we talked about that. What he was doing in the period that he was away, was covering World War II, the Chinese Civil War, the Korean War, because he was there on the very first week or two of the Korean War. He was in Taijiang and almost got killed there, which is in central South Korea. So I was asking him an awful lot of questions about him, and I said, we've got to sit down and let's do this systematically. And so that's how it all began. We were living together at that time in Arlington, and I got a typewriter and you know, asked him questions, and he responded. Initially, I wanted him to, he was very sick at this time. So initially, I wanted to get him to just do it himself, you know, just talk. He could talk to a tape recorder, but he couldn't do it. I would leave the tape recorder, turn it on and everything, and there'd be nothing on the tape recorder, and because he had, while I was going to work, because I was still at the, I was at the Times Washington Bureau at that time, and so I'd leave him alone, and then there would be nothing on the tape recorder, and so I would get a little bit angry, and he just said, well, I just can't do it. So what I did was just get a fast typewriter. I was a pretty fast typist in those days, very fast, and so I would just take down his answers of the questions, and I would just ask him one question after the other, and he would sort of relive his experiences during this period that we lived together. He would relive these experiences for you know, the duration of our sort of interviews. We would do this about an hour, 2 hours every night in Arlington, in this beautiful apartment, very nice apartment we had when we were living together, not too far from the Pentagon, actually. And so that's how the book started. And I just took notes all the time. And of course, I had to fill it up, you know, because a lot of the stuff he was talking about, I didn't even understand. And I had to, you know, get basic information about, you know, what the war in China was all about, and who MacArthur was, and who Chiang Kai-shek was, and these things. So I had to, you know, put on my my thinking cap as well. But we slowly pursued, and I'm talking now in the 1980s. Of course, he died in 1984, so this is in the early 1980s. And then I had huge amounts of notes and everything else, and of course I was doing other things, including, to me it was a project. It was a project of love and everything else, but it wasn't the top priority for me. I was trying to write a novel at the same time. I was, you know, working very hard at the Times, at Washington Bureau, and so I just decided to you know, I didn't push this project that fast. And of course he passed away, which was horrible. And then suddenly I've got all these notes, and I've got to do something. And so it has taken me four decades to put everything together. And you know, it's been a huge, huge project. It's sort of like I feel like Samuel Johnson, you know, or he was sort of like Samuel Johnson answering the questions of James Boswell, for example, you know, back in the 18th century, because I was just asking all these these questions, going into the minutia of his life, and he would respond, I went to Yale. And when I was at Yale, there were a lot of there were big in 18th century studies. I studied English, and there were a couple of professors there. One was Frederick Pottle, and the other was Chauncey Tinker. And they were both wonderful English professors, and they both were students of the 18th century. And so I'd always had this idea that if you could just, you know, sit around and ask questions and everything, you could learn everything that you really needed to know about the world. And so I was quite impressed by of course the you know, Boswell's Life of Johnson, and I'm also impressed, although I haven't fully read it, the Winston Churchill's son, you know, Randolph, wrote a wonderful biography of his father. It was only one volume, but anyway, I was influenced and impressed by those works, and they were always in the back of my mind. I said, you know, I've got to do something similar to this with my own dad, because he's lived in these amazing times, and you know, he saved the lives of two journalists during the Chinese Civil War, and I only learned about that when I was in Prague in 1968. My dad and I were both there together, and one of the men whose life he saved, his name was George Vine, who worked for the London Daily Mail. he came up to me and he said, "You know, your father saved my life in Shanghai." And I said, I didn't know that. And he said, "You know, I'll ask your father about it someday." And so I later, you know, during these sessions that we had in Arlington in the 1980s, I did. I asked him all about that. And I asked him, I said, "Why haven't you told me about this before?" And he said, "Because you never asked." And so that's the kind of situation that we were living through. And as I say, it took took all this period of time to work this thing out.
One of the things that came to mind as you were talking, and it was just in gathering all the information from him, like that last statement you made that you never asked, you know, so he didn't tell you. But was he willing to share information? You know, being on the flip side of the questions, you know, with his career and your career as journalist, but did you get a sense of how he felt being the subject?
I think he loved it.
Yeah.
I think he was always, you see, I've always been rather, you know, feeling, you know, had inferiority complexes, et cetera. Whereas he was just the opposite. He was always, he loved to do parlor tricks. He would tell stories. I mean, he was really if you think of Orson Welles, he looked a little bit like Orson Welles in Citizen Kane. I mean, he was in that great movie about Vienna, The Third Man. But he loved to be the center of attraction. So he wanted to tell his story very much, and he was wondering why the hell I hadn't asked. He was wondering what kind of a reporter I was, hanging around and not even asking him about, you know, these fantastic experiences that he had had in China. I mean, you know, this was incredible. And then those days, that days in the Korean War were mind blowing too. But not only that, but he had, you know, amazing experiences in Europe, because he later, you know, his second wife was a Viennese, and she was also a friend of Simon Wiesenthal, who was the great Nazi hunter and everything. And my father wrote a wonderful. My father wrote this wonderful magazine for the New York Times magazine about Simon Wiesenthal. It was the first, you know, mainstream article about Wiesenthal in the in the American press, and that was quite important as well. So he and that life in Vienna that he had was in the middle of the Cold War, you know, Vienna in those days. This is now in the 70s and 60s and 70s. If you remember, well, you wouldn't remember that period, but it was a very, very hectic period. And there, you didn't know whether, you know, we were going to have a World War III tomorrow, and everybody's spies were spying on everybody else. And it was an incredible situation. And he set himself up as a reporter in Vienna to report on this kind of situation, and he represented a number of, including the New York Times. That's how he eventually joined the New York Times, but never as a permanent staffer, but always as a stringer. And so I was greatly admiring of his ability to, you know, because it's a very tough profession. Mm-hmm. The news profession, it's not a profession for old men. It's you don't grow old as a newsman. So it's just very, very, very hard. So I had a tremendous amount of respect. He was able to pick himself up. He lost jobs. He was fired from the AP, mainly because of his relationship with his second wife, who, as I say, was a Holocaust survivor. But they met in Iran, and then later he took her to China, and They had a wonderful life together, a very rather dangerous life. I mean, it was sort of the kind of life that you would have, you know, that you would, you know, that you would think of in these 30s or 40s movies, with all sorts of crazy happenings behind the scenes and everything, and everybody sort of laying for everybody else. So it was not that easy a situation. So anyway, I had great respect for him, and then he built up this freelance network, which was incredible. He was representing at one point NBC News. He was representing the Times. He was representing the Chicago Tribune. He was representing the Reader's Digest, and he was Medical Weekly, Medical News, among other things. He had an amazing Stringer network, and he'd asked me to join him. He wanted me to join him in Vienna to help him, because he was overwhelmed by all this activity that he had to do. And suddenly, but at this time, I had a pretty good job with the Times in London, and I, you know, thought to myself, and my wife at that time, Barbara, she is, you know, was not particularly anxious to go to London, go to Vienna when we were living in London. We just had a child and everything else. So I had to tell him no. And so instead of taking me, he was a little bit angry about that. And so, but instead of taking me, he got a wonderful guy named Charles John. Well, he got four or five men, including my younger brother. But let me just talk to you about Charles Johnson was from south side of Chicago, and he came. To Vienna via the U.S. Army, and he was a African American actor, and my father went to one of his plays and found him. They had a wonderful time together, and he invited him to work for him as a kind of stringer or something for his Vienna this agency that he was creating. And so Charles Johnson came there and worked there for a while, and then suddenly my father wrote a piece for a magazine about this, and Johnson got so much notoriety that he left, and then another fellow my father found Dutchko Doder, who became a reporter for the Washington Post, and a little later he got my younger brother to work for him even. So there were it was a huge operation, but we were, you know, then gradually we drew closer together, you know, as I would visit and everything else, and the fact that I did not join him. He later felt we sort of made amends about the fact that, because he was upset that I didn't join him, but he did very well. He did very. I just want to mention one thing. When I came back from Europe in the 1970s, Charles Johnson made a special trip from Chicago. He'd later gone to the Harvard Business School. I don't know where he came from. He might have been coming from Harvard at this moment. But he'd gotten a degree at Harvard, but he came to Washington, and he came into the office, and he just came up to my desk, and it was incredible. And he said, you know, I wanted to tell you this personally, that what an important figure your father was in my life, and I wanted you to know this, etc., etc. And it was just an amazing moment. So this was the other part of it. As I said, what was happening in China was incredible, but also what he constructed in Vienna, this Stringer operation that he had was also incredible. And so he was really a rather all round journalistic empresario.
Well, given everything that you've done in your career and he's done in his career and your lives, you know, together and apart, I mean, how did you choose? I mean, you have two lives full of, you know, happenings, right? How did you choose what you included? Obviously things had to be left out, but how did you end up kind of prioritizing what needed to be featured and what didn't?
Well, thank you for asking. Yeah, that obviously was very difficult, and, mm-hmm. and a lot of good stuff has been left out, unfortunately. But I tried to, just do it naturally. What flows naturally. So I tried to talk about his youth a little bit and everything, and then the grandparents that he had, etc., who were very important to his life, and then I tried to sort of segue into my own life and how we sort of dovetailed. But there, obviously, I was very much interested in the whole World War II, because World War II is never going to end. I mean, it's always with us. And you think about it. I think about Ward Wingate in Burma, the jungle fighters. I think about Chenault and the Air Force and the 14th Air Force. I think about Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong, and this is all part of it's classic. It'll never die. It's part of the fabric of our lives, or at least my life. I mean, you wouldn't remember this as much as I do, but for me, this was like, it would be like my father, remembering the Battle of the Somme, or my mother remembering the Battle of Verdun in World War I. I mean, these are things that as far as the people of my generation are concerned, will never go away. I mean, World War II, as far as we're concerned, just never ends. So it was just a question of prioritizing, mm-hmm. and trying to tell a story in a logical fashion, and you learn to do this eventually as a newspaper man, especially if you're working on a big takeout, as you must tell your students. It must be very similar. You have to take, it doesn't always have to be what's most important. You tell the story as it sort of flows, make it flow and make people understand it and have a sense of what's going on. That I think that's the most important, so that they realize that it's a that it's a story, but it has a point of view, and you try to tell it in a concise but at the same time full manner.
Do you think that you had like a similar approach, writing this book as you did to your journalistic writing, or did you feel like it was different?
Oh, I think it was different. I really do, because mm-hmm. the journalistic writing, was first of all, it wasn't. I wasn't looking at a tableau so much. I was looking at individual things in what I was covering. When I went to England, for example, the big thing that I was covering, I was the editor. I was a reporter for the coal miners. My big story in those days was the disappearing coal mines in the central part of England, and that was a very, very, very sad story, and it's incredible that story is still around. We've got that story today in Pennsylvania and West Virginia. And it's the same story, exact same story that I wrote 50 years ago or 40 years ago in England. There was a place called Colville, Coalville. I never thought that, and it's still there. And there were huge mines there. And I remember going into the mine, talking to the guys there, and just wondering why on earth they wanted to work in those pits. And the reason they did is because they were getting good money for going into the mine. They were very good money, But at the same time, what they liked more than anything else, and I got a sense of this too when I was in the army, when I was in Korea, was the buddy factor. I mean, you were really close to your buddies, and that was important. You go down with a minor, another minor, and you would do anything for that guy, and just the same way as you would in the if you're in Korea or if you were in Vietnam or something, and you were with a friend. I mean, with a buddy, you would save his life, he would save yours. I mean, there was just no question about that. That buddy factor is very important in the whole mining industry, especially when you're risking your life and in those awful places. So that was a big factor, too, plus the money. So that was those were factors that I was trying to bring out in my various reporting life.
And I was thinking, you mentioned, you know, kind of the journalistic approach, you know, prioritizing information. And I was thinking about, you know, who, if you had a particular audience in mind, or do you have hopes of who you'd like to read this book, or what you want them to take away from the text?
Well, yes. Well, I mean, I obviously I hope everyone reads it.
And buys it.
I don't really care whether they buy it so long as they read it. I'm not in this, and I'm not in it for the money. I never was. But anyway, I like to write. I like to. I think these stories are important. That's the thing. I mean, the air war in China. First of all, people don't know about it. I bet you today people don't, you know, haven't even heard of Claire Chennault, and they don't know about the Japanese offensive, for example, in Western China. There was a major Japanese offensive in 1944. It was almost as big as the Battle of the Bulge. Now, we've heard about the Battle of the Bulge in Western Europe, and where Hitler almost broke through the Allied lines and captured Antwerp, and we know about that, but we don't realize that the Japanese were doing almost the same thing. Hello. Oh, are you there?
Oh yeah, I'm still here.
I'm sorry, I didn't know what that sound was. So the Japanese were almost doing the same. And had they succeeded, you know, had Hitler succeeded, you know, the Third Reich might still be around. You know, had the Japanese succeeded, they could still be in Burma, in Indochina, in Thailand. They were the Japanese, even in 1944, had a band of occupation that stretched from Shanghai, and then they were moving into Western China, southwestern China, you know, and Vietnam, and had they succeeded, they could have had a belt all the way through to the South China Sea. So it was really a very, very important thing, and that would have kept, maybe had Japan would have had a major force in, you know, on the continent of Asia, which is always what they wanted, but of course there was a chance that they might have gotten that. And that was one of my father's big stories was covering that. It was basically an air campaign, but the Chinese Chiang Kai-shek devoted some troops to fighting the Japanese offensive there, and that was a major thing. But of course, it got very little play because you know, how can you cover, you have to cover the Battle of the Bulge. The Russians were doing all these crazy things, and so was everything was happening, you know, all over the world. So it was very, very difficult. Another interesting thing, I was particularly fascinated by the whole question of security, when my father flew on a B-29 raid, he was the only reporter on a B-29 called Monsoon over Anshan, and the Anshan was a steel mill in Manchuria, and it was a daylight raid, and they took off from a place in western China called Chengdu, and they flew about 8 hours to the China Sea, North China Sea, and they had to go into Manchuria, and then they flew all the way back. And it was a very, very dangerous mission, and these new B-29s were very new and everything, and the B-29 that my father was in, after about 3 or 4 days of monsoons, it was a very, very difficult takeoff. The ground was very, very wet and soggy and was very hard to get airspeed. And finally, the B-29 took off, but its radar blister on the bottom, in the belly of the plane, had been shattered. So after the 8 hours, the Colonel Laverne Saunders, his name was, he called my father up to the cockpit, and he said, you know, we've got this. We're disabled because our radar is not working, so we don't have to go to the main target. We can go to a secondary target. And if we go to the secondary target, you know, obviously it would be less dangerous for everybody. And he asked me, I want you to make that decision. I want you to. I'm not going to do it. And so Colonel Saunders said, you, the AP correspondent, you're going to make that. Well, my father said, I want my ticket punched for the full ride. And so he would, I think about that. I've thought about it a lot, actually, because, you know, he was not only sure he wanted a good story, but he was also endangering the 11 men in that plane who could have been shot down as a result of his wanting a good story. And I'm still trying to think of that balance. To him, there was no question. I mean, if he was shot down, it was fine. But he was also affecting the lives of these other men. And that was I don't know whether he had the right, whether God gave him the right to do that or not. But at any rate, it was a very, very difficult choice. But he didn't think more than 10 seconds or even less than that, 2 seconds over that answer, because it was so obvious to him that he had to get the ticket punched for the full ride. There was another kind of interesting incident as a result of that too. It was the fact that when they went for their briefing before they took off, there was another colonel, and he was the intelligence guy, and he said, before you leave, I want you all to remember that there is this one thing you got to remember about this mission. Make sure that you don't forget, and he was going over all the points that he was making with his pointer and everything, and the maps and everything else. And then he said, "Any questions?" And okay. And then one guy yells from the back of this shed where they were having their briefing. He yells, "Egging your borscht." And so my father was working for the AP then, and he wrote the story, "Egg in your borscht." Egg in your borscht. Now, egg in your borscht is a term that was used, you know, back in 50, 60 years ago, something, the borscht belt and the Catskills. And egg in your borscht is obviously a very, very special way of having borscht. So it was kind of and that's what my father thought. That's all it was, just a special term. So he used this as a kicker in the AP story. And the colonel later saw the AP story published, and he became apoplectic, and he went to my father and he said that was a very, very secret code word, and that he wasn't supposed to, it was not supposed to be used in any kind of newspaper traffic. Because egg in your borscht happened to have been Joe Stalin in those days did not want American planes in Russia, in Siberia. But he was finally persuaded at a summit conference that he had in Tehran with Roosevelt and Chiang Kai-shek, I think, was even at that conference. He was finally persuaded to allow disabled planes that were bombing Japan or the Japanese islands to land in Siberia near Vladivostok. And so, but it was a very highly secret protocol, and nobody was supposed to know. And the term of that, and the code word for that was, code term for that was egg in your borscht. And so when my father wrote egg in your borscht for the AP, and that appeared, it was giving away one of the most secret parts of World War II relationships between Roosevelt and Stalin, and the ability for American planes to land on Soviet territory, and so that was a so the colonel was extremely upset. Well, and it actually turned out, I did some research on this, that about three or four B-29s actually did land. There were landing in or around Vladivostok that had been disabled by Japanese fire, Japanese anti-aircraft. And as a result of that, those planes, the Russians, there was a fellow named, I forget his first name, I think it was Igor Tupolev. You know, if you've heard of the Tupolev planes. Well, there were the Tupolev 4. I got this from a Russian friend. He said that the Tupolev 4 was reverse engineered at that period from the B-29s. That had landed, for safe passage in Vladivostok. So that's how the Russian air fleet started. And the Tupolev became a very important plane for the Russian fleet. So anyway, there are all those wonderful stories that I was just afraid that, I think that's just too good a story to forget about. Mm-hmm. And I think that. And I hope people will think the same way.
Well, I think as our listeners probably will attest to, this is kind of the tip of the iceberg of the stories that they'll read about in your book. I think we're going to probably start to wrap up because you've taken a chunk of your time today. But I was wondering if do you have any plans for any other projects or... are you working on anything else now?
Oh, well, thank you for asking. Mm-hmm. I am, I've been working on a kind of screenplay, but I don't know whether it'll work or not. But anyway, it's an amazing period that I think should be captured in the celluloid screen if possible. So that's my project now is to try to do something along those lines, and it's a wonderful love story. I mean, the my father's love for this woman in she was a Holocaust survivor, as I say, she became very, very dear to him and everything else. Of course, they later had a terrible fight, but anyway, the beauty of it is not in the fight, but in the earlier love. They were very close. So, and of course, my mother was terribly upset, and then I guess rightfully so too. So, because he left her with very little. So anyway, there were a lot of things like that that I'd like to explore a little bit more. And I thought maybe I think a movie would do well, but I've got to sort of tap my Hollywood contacts on that.
Well, that sounds like a very interesting project. And I really wanted to thank you, Clyde, for being on the show today. I really enjoyed hearing all of the stories and more that kind of expanding on what you've covered in the book, your book as well. So I just wanted to say thank you and good luck with your future projects. Maybe we'll see you on the screen.
Yeah, that would be great.
Awesome. Well, take care. Thank you again.
Thank you very much, Professor.